Everybody know everybody here?
No. Some people know some people. I'll introduce myself and the persons that came with me, and I'll assume that you know at least somebody here. My name is Ramapada Swami, and I've been a member of the Hare Krishna movement. Let's see now. About 41 years. Something like that. 41 or 42 years. And I travel every now and then. Constantly. And I've been visiting here in the Northwest area, and for the past 5-6 years, I've made several trips here to Corvallis, and I like visiting Corvallis. And the family that kindly drove me here from Portland, Jai Satchinandana, is a temple president at the Portland Center, and his wife, Bhakti Rasa, daughter. Maybe her daughter will. Yep. Is there a harmonium here? Okay, later. No. You can get it, but later she can sing it. She sings very nicely. Much better than I do. And should I safely assume that we have some new people here? Is there anybody present that's not familiar with Bhagavad Gita? Not familiar with Bhagavad Gita. You've heard of the title before, but what's inside the book is not so clear. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Bhagavad Gita. I had a different idea, but I think I'll go to. Just introducing Bhagavad Gita and let's discuss one verse from Bhagavad Gita. Like the cover shows, well, it's even better. Just inside the cover, take a look, just inside the cover. There's a picture, a painting, of Krishna and Arjuna, who are your friends here. And they're in the middle of a chariot. It's in the middle of a vast army on both sides, left side, right side. Those are big armies. And the scene is, just before this battle is about to begin, one of the chief leading heroes, soldiers, great warriors, named Arjuna, he is asking Krishna to please draw the chariot in front of, in between the two armies, so he can see who's on both sides and get like a sense of what's about to happen. The situation is, before the battle was to take place, there were three brothers, elder, middle, and younger brother. The elder brother was Dhritarashtra, and when he was born blind. The elder brother, by Vedic system, would have become the king. But because he was born blind, he was not eligible to become king. The second son, or brother, was named Pandu. And Pandu, being the second brother, was to become king. And the third brother's name was Vidura. There's a lot to say about how they became brothers, but they were brothers. And so Pandu became king, and he had five sons. They were called Pandavas, the sons of Pandu. And the eldest of those five sons, his name was Yudhisthira. Yudhisthira was like the emblem of virtue. the eldest of Dhritarashtra's son was just the opposite. He was the emblem of conniving, skullduggery, get what you want by any means. So it was like a, wasn't very nice. Duryodhana and his brothers. So it's like that was, the, as the story unfolds, a classic good versus evil drama. It was, so within, it's within, this Bhagavad Gita is the middle portion of a much bigger epic describing the history of Greater India, or in Sanskrit, Mahabharata. It's a history, and the history of kings, and in the course of the unfolding of the drama of Bhagavad, of Mahabharata, we're finding on this side and on that side all kinds of discussion about virtue, duty, what is right, what is to be done, what is not to be done. And we have personalities that are displaying both. And as the story unfolds, the Vedic system is that each of the social orders, they have a means to maintain themselves. I'm addressing you three because you're the ones that sit. So, the brahmanas, they're in the social order, like the head, arms, torso, legs, divisions of labor within Vedic society. So the head division, the brahmanas, their occupation is six. They teach and they study. They worship and they show others how to worship. They receive charity and they give in charity. There's Sanskrit terminology for each of those things, but that's a standard legitimate means for those who are teachers. In other words, in Vedic culture, teachers can get paid. Get education, get a job, and get a salary. They didn't do it that way. It was because people were pious. If someone could offer knowledge, they offered charity. They would give grains. They would give necessities of life. Sometimes they would give coins, a bowl, and cows, and just things that would maintain them. That was the Vedic system. And the arms department, those who would give protection to the rest of the social body, they gave protection, and their means was of livelihood was they would receive taxes, not bribes, not charity, but they would extract taxes. They were the landholders, and people would take care of the land, and they would maintain peace, and they would give some part of the production of the land to the landholder. He would give protection. And large tracts of land was the king, and he had his military that gave protection to his citizens, and they gave taxes, and so on, without going through the whole social divisions. So the Pandavas were the arms. They were Kshatriyas. They were giving protection. And in the course of the drama, there are many attempts to murder them. There were attempts to steal their property. There were attempts to disgrace and defile their wife. All of them, by Vedic codes, punishable, like severely punishable. But the Pandavas, they didn't want to fight with their cousins. So Krishna volunteered, I'll go on your behalf and I'll seek peace. I'll make a peace offer. You keep the whole planet. Just give each of us Pandavas five states. You keep the whole rest of the planet. And they'll be under you. No. Five cities, no. Five villages, no. Four. So, as Bhagavad Gita unfolds, Arjuna sees what's about to happen, and turns to Krishna and says, I don't want to do this. Although it's by codes of scripture that we are to maintain ourselves by giving protection and then receiving taxes from those who we give protection to. If it means fighting against our cousins and all these people are going to be destroyed, including on that side is our teacher and our grandfather and all these people that are so dear to us, tell you what, I'll just stop being a Kshatriya. I'll become a mendicant. I'll just go to the forest and live on roots and herbs and whatever leaves are there, and I'll just like renounce my duty of being a Kshatriya. And he gives many other reasons why he doesn't want to go through with. He gives very good, like the other parts of Bhagavad Gita, very moral, ethical, high-sounding reasons why I'm not going to do it. I don't want to do this. He doesn't even just say, I don't want to do it. I'm not going to do it. But his whole body is trembling, and he feels bewildered, and then submits to Krishna, I don't really know what's best for me to do. Can you please instruct me? So the whole dynamic changes from the whole rest of the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna, where Krishna and Arjuna are best of friends. And now Krishna is in the position of being a teacher or a guru, and Arjuna is in the position of what is being taught or disciple. So out of the whole of the Mahabharata, this right and wrong, good and evil, what's duty, what's to be done, what's not to be done, dialogue, comes some spiritual instruction. So the beginning of what Krishna says, and I'm saying all of this in a paraphrased way, the first thing that Krishna says is, before we talk about what's your duty, let's talk about who you are. Novel consideration. And then we can talk about what your duty is. So, the first part of Bhagavad Gita's instruction is just describing the soul. And what the soul is distinct from the body. And what the qualities of the soul are, and the qualities of matter are, and they're quite distinct. It's very rich. All religions of the world that I'm aware of have this idea that there's a soul. But ask different people of different religions what the soul is, and you might get very different answers. I've done that, and I've gotten very different answers. But in Bhagavad Gita, it's very clear what the soul is. And then after describing what the soul is, Krishna then says, the next challenge is to maintain that understanding or consciousness of I am spirit soul while you do your activities. You know, it's one thing to have a theoretical understanding of something, but then how do you practically retain that understanding while you do activity? And part of the problem of when you do activity is, commonly, people are doing activity because they're attached to the fruit of the activity. We work because we want the fruit of our work. People go to their jobs because they get paid. Supposing they didn't get paid, how many people go to work? Not very many people. So what's it like to work without attachment to the fruits of your work? So that's a nice discussion. That's in chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita. And Arjuna's slowly getting it, but it's he's not perfectly clear. Krishna then describes the absolute truth, or the transcendental knowledge, and summarizing chapter 4, the nature of God, like it's distinct from the soul, is the Supreme Soul. Krishna gives, he reveals truths about the Supreme Soul, about God, and says that if one can understand the nature of the Supreme Soul, this is sufficient to deliver one from the cycle of birth and death. Because otherwise, as he explained earlier, because one is bound, you work, and you're attached to the fruits of your work, and then you receive the fruits of your work, and you're bound to the karma of your actions and reactions, and you stay in the cycle of birth and death. Indefinitely, theoretically. But if you can take shelter of understanding of the Supreme Soul and act for the Supreme Soul with detachment from your, the fruits of your work, but attachment to the Supreme, then it frees you from the cycle of birth and death. So that is another chapter, acting in consciousness of the Supreme. Now we're almost getting to where I want to speak one verse. The sixth chapter is then Krishna explains the process of Dhyan Yoga or meditation. All of these have their terminologies connected with yoga. Working for the Supreme is Karma Yoga. Knowledge of the Supreme and trying to link with the Supreme through knowledge is Gyan Yoga. Knowledge of yoga of knowledge. Then meditational yoga or Dhyan Yoga. And at the end of the chapter on meditation, meditational yoga, Krishna says, of all the different things that one can do in life, best of all is to fix your mind upon the Supreme. And of all methods of fixing your mind upon the Supreme, the best of all of them is the yoga of devotion. That's the last verse of chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita. So what I've just done is taken you through the first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita very quickly. So now I wanted to read a verse that's the first verse of chapter 7. So in Bhagavad Gita, there's 18 chapters. And there are commentators of the Bhagavad Gita have said that it's in divisions of 3, 6, 6, and 6. The first six are primarily speaking about working with detachment from the fruits of work. Karma phala tyag, renouncing the fruits of work. If we have more people coming in through the back, and a few people in the front can get really cozy up here, I'll be very comfortable. And then people in the back can come and sit in. Welcome. Okay. The middle six chapters of Bhagavad Gita are primarily addressing bhakti or devotion to the Supreme. The final six chapters are primarily addressing jnana or knowledge. So we have on these two sides karma yoga and jnana yoga, or work with the spirit of detachment and knowledge that connects one with the Supreme. And in between are chapters that describe the culmination of those two, which is devotion. You know what is the Supreme and you detach from the fruits of work, you work for the Supreme. You work not just giving the results to the Supreme, which is the first part, but with devotion for the Supreme. So here's the verse. I'll read the Sanskrit. Chapter 7. Maya saktatmana partha yogam yunjanmadashrayava samshayam samagramam yata gyasyasi tashtrunu. Translation. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, now hear, O son of Pritha, how, by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, You can know me in full, free from doubt. So, this is a it's Krishna's proclaiming coming attractions. He's going to explain, because the previous verse was, and in fact the whole section was culminating in become fixed in yoga, and of all forms of yoga, Shadhavan Bhajate Yoma Samayukta Uttama Mataha. Uttama means topmost. Ut is upward. Uttama is the topmost. And of all the systems of yoga, yoginam api sarvesham, of all the systems of yoga, that which is the topmost system of yoga is, in Krishna's opinion, mataha, is shraddhavan bhajate yomam. Shraddha means faith, and van means one who possesses. So, shraddhavan, in faith, bhajate yomam. Bhaj is the root word of bhakti, and bhaj means engaging, specifically means engaging our senses in practical activity. In other words, it's not just an internal state, like, you know, a feeling. Because some persons have that idea. In the process of devotion, there's feelings. Feelings are natural. It's okay to have feelings. And feelings in relation to the Supreme. They're the impetus for practical activity. You know, whatever is inside comes out. Whatever those things are that we have very strong feelings about, it comes out. And if those strong feelings are towards the Supreme, it comes out in practical activity. We work, bringing our senses in contact with objects of the senses, for the satisfaction of the Supreme. So that's the explanation of what this bhajate. It's practical activity. In the language of Narada Pancharatha, Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam Bhakti Ruchate. Engaging the senses in the service of the master of the senses. That's what bhakti is. Practical activity. I'm making this emphasis because the scriptures make this emphasis. We do things, and there's a mood with which we do those things. We do those things as a service unto the Supreme. Or another verse in this chapter 7, Krishna says, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever charity you do, whatever austerity you do, whatever you do, do that as a form or expression of worship of the Supreme. So, in the beginning of this chapter 7, Krishna is saying, I'm now going to explain to you how you can do that. And there's two things that he says are essential components. Your mind becomes fixed upon Krishna, and your consciousness is absorbed in him. And I'm going to explain to you how that can be achieved. When the founder Acharya of the Hare Krishna movement that I've been part of for so many years spoke at random, like some gathering like this or wherever he was, there's recordings of those classes that he gave, and the recordings were then later transcribed so that we could read what he had said. And when those persons that were engaged in making those transcriptions, they found that this one verse was the he spoke on more often than any other verse. And so it's an important verse. The first is why, and then how to. The why part is from the previous chapters. Because we're spirit soul, very simple principle. Souls, by nature, are active. They're the animating factor of the body. When the soul leaves the body is no longer active. In fact, it disintegrates. The elements go back to their elemental stage. And when the soul is present, they're integrated and they're animated. It appears that the body is alive, when in fact, the body isn't alive. It's the soul that's alive. And the soul is active. So, since souls are active, now you have this principle of karma. If you perform activity, there's the action, there's a karmic reaction. Karma is like a double-edged sword. It's action, what you do, or work. And it's reaction. From the laws of nature, something you do in goodness, some act of kindness or compassion or well-being unto others, that goodness comes back. And acts of cruelty that cause pain and suffering for others, that pain and suffering comes back. And life has its mix. Even if we don't intend to do something that causes pain and suffering to other living beings, just by your existence, other living beings are offering their existences to sustain our existence. That's the way this place is designed. As long as you have a body. And it doesn't work to just like get rid of the body. Like commit suicide or something. It's not a solution because you don't have the right to take the life. There's a very severe karmic reaction for that. So you act and there's bondage and you can't not act. So what's a good person to do? What's the solution? The solution that's offered is acting where the fruits of your work are offered in sacrifice unto the Supreme. And as you carry on the activities of life, cultivating that, offering the results of one's activities unto the Supreme, a degree of detachment from results and even the whole worldly condition. And in that state of detachment, more tendency towards higher knowledge or spiritual knowledge or subtle contemplations become natural. They arise. And one thinks beyond the temporary into the permanent or the eternal. So knowledge of the soul and knowledge of the Supreme and becoming fixed in that Supreme and concentrating that in meditation upon the Supreme. That's like a gradual, step-by-step, many lifetimes perhaps, progression. However, there's like that's a staircase and there's an elevator. Our spiritual master described like this because he began speaking or presenting the teachings of Bhagavad Gita in New York City, so he gave the example of the Empire State Building. And it's true, when I visited the Empire State Building, there's a staircase and there's an elevator. If you want to go to the top floor, you can walk the staircase. Long hike up the staircase. Or you can ride the elevator. And if you ride the elevator, they have two banks. One of them goes like so many, and then you get out and you go to another one, it goes another bunch of floors up. But if there's fire, they have a staircase. You can go all the way down. Not too many people use that. Nobody goes up like that. But from floor to floor, they may. So, the bhakti process is compared to the elevator. And it's a means by which very directly and maybe not even knowingly, like the process of chanting that we just did at the very beginning. by sound vibration, consciousness is brought in contact with the Supreme. And that the whole of the Vedas is based on sound. The Vedic picture, the picture of the Vedic wisdom is, Krishna says it in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita. At the very beginning, Krishna sent forth generations of men and demigods. But he also presented this sound vibration. And with the sound vibration, a means of connecting again to the Supreme. So, the understanding at least is that spiritual sounds emanate directly from the spiritual world, and you connect the process of hearing with that spiritual sound, and your consciousness is connected with the Supreme. And once again, when your consciousness is connected with the Supreme, what's inside comes out. Your activities become in harmony with the Supreme. There's detailed knowledge of how to act in relation to the Supreme, but it's not just behaviors, it's consciousness. Because behaviors come from consciousness. So both must be there. Purification of consciousness and elevation of consciousness, and direction as far as practical activity is concerned. Srila Prabhupada has given this example of a train that moves on two tracks and they're parallel. And if one of the tracks is missing, you've got a problem. The train's going to capsize. It won't go very far. And with spiritual life, similarly, two things are required. A means to purify consciousness, and parallel with that is a direction of practical activities in life. And one without the other is a problem. Some means of purification without proper direction can become sentiment, and sentimentality can become fanaticism, and fanaticism, we know, can be very dangerous. The other side is if you just have practical activity, but without the purified state of consciousness, it remains theory, and it doesn't take you where you want to go. So both are needed. A means, in this bhakti process, there's a means to purify consciousness. That's primarily through this spiritual sound, and particularly for this age, the description is through the sound of the holy name of God, Harir Nama, Harir Nama, Harir Nama Eva Kevalam. Kalo nastyeva, nastyeva, nastyeva gatir anyaka, a very famous verse that's saying, by calling or vibrating the names of God, names of Hari, then by that means one can achieve the goal, gatihi, the spiritual goal of life. And other means are not going to be effective, and it says it three times. Na asti eva. So it's emphatic. That's the means of purification of consciousness. And so a very essential part of bhakti is that there's a means of purifying consciousness primarily through sacred sounds, names of God. And instruction and how to live your life. Just like the issue in Bhagavad Gita is, Arjuna is asking, what's my duty? Here's a dilemma. I have a situation where if I do what looks like I'm supposed to do, there's consequences I don't want. But if I don't do my duty, then there'll also be implication in a bad result just from failing to do what I'm supposed to do. So, in such a dilemma, we need some guidance and what's to be done. We also need, now the other side, the proper consciousness to do that which is to be done. So, Krishna is going to explain in the whole of Bhagavad Gita both the means of purification and elevation of consciousness by the devotional yoga process, and a practical instruction as to what the duties of life are. There's many nice things here. Part of the reason for picking this verse is I just spent the whole Thanksgiving weekend in Seattle covering a section of Srimad Bhagavatam, and the section is quoted in this purport, where the stages of bhakti, from seed to full fruits and flowers and the full mature stage of bhakti, is described. In each of those stages, the same thing is mentioned in this verse that Krishna says, touch Shrinu, in the last line of this Bhagavad Gita verse. Tat Shrinu. Shrinu has to do with the hearing process. Hear from me. So the whole process of bhakti is similarly based upon hearing. Shrinvatasva Kata Krishna. Punya. Shravana Kirtana is the first verse that's quoted. By the process of hearing, the heart becomes cleansed of impurities or contaminations of heart. Abhadras is the word in the verse. Things that are inauspicious and unwanted within the heart. And rather than repeating the whole week-long seminar, stage slowly, step by step, the stages of bhakti awaken, just like taking a seed. You have a tulsi plant here? All over the corner. So part of our process of worship is involving a tulsi plant. And when the tulsi plant is mature, there's little flowers at the top, manjaris, and then the manjaris produce seeds. Then you can take the seed of the tulsi and plant the seed and get another tulsi plant. So within the seed is the potency of life. And similarly, the seed of the Vedas teach, that seed, or the potential, the dormant stage of love of God is within the heart of every living being. And by the process of hearing, that seed germinates. So there's, around the seed, there's a shell, or some kind of a nice nature's, Mother Nature's covering. And inside there's life. And that life will stay. Just like if you take a seed and put it in a frying pan, the life will be driven out. But if you don't do that, it can stay. Shelf life will be a long time. Nice covering. There's life inside. But to get the life inside to come out, there's a sprouting process. So similarly, love of God is within the heart of every living being, in this process of hearing, awakens that dormant love of God, and it appears in its preliminary stages in the form of practices of devotion, sadhana bhakti, and it matures in course of time without all the detail that's described in the purport here. Slowly, step by step, that creeper or the plant of the life of devotion unfolds, and it matures in predictable stages, just like you got a little seed and grow the plant, and you can, because it's done so many, many times, you know what the stages are. What I'm saying here is while it's teaching of devotion or love for God, it's a science. It's like predictable, like anything else that's a science. You have a hypothesis or premise, and you do some experiment, you make some observations, and you make some conclusions. And anybody can do the experiment and get the same conclusions, same results. Similarly, the process, that what's described in Bhagavad Gita is that. It's a science of how to take that which is dormant inside the heart and bring it to the stage of full maturity, of love of God, Krishna Prema, where mind is fully fixed upon the Supreme, consciousness absorbed in the Supreme. It's dormant within the heart of every living being. And Krishna is saying, I'm going to explain to you how that can happen. So I've tried to summarize very simply. A lot of information is in Bhagavad Gita. The process of awakening devotion within the heart. And in the mature stage, the final instruction that Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita is that all the other forms of religious duty, some of you know the verse, sarva dharmam parityaja mamekam sharanam praja aham tvam sarva papevyo moksha yashami masuchaha. All the other forms, because the whole of Bhagavad Gita has been describing duty, virtue, dharma, Krishna is making this very strong, conclusive statement that all other forms of dharma are subsidiary and they're subordinate to the primary. And the primary dharma, or paradharma, the main essence, is to bring oneself to the point of full surrender and submission to the personality of Godhead. And that happens when there's love. One will always think of someone if you love that someone. You don't have to tell the young boy that has a romantic attraction for the young girl, or vice versa. Now think of him, or think of her. They're always thinking of him or thinking of her because they're romantically in love. When they're supposed to be, you know, eating, they don't have an appetite, they're thinking of him or her, and so on. That's a reflection of the pure state of love of God. In the state of love of God, whatever it is, there's the practicing stage and then there's the mature stage. In the mature stage, whatever it is that one does is in relation to the Supreme, in relation to God, the object of my love, the beloved. And as we find that in this world, it exists in this world because it has its spiritual counterpart. And the mature stage, as described in Bhagavad Gita, is to come to that position. When that position awakens, knowledge is naturally there. Detachment from the illusory features of material existence is naturally there. In fact, all desirable things are naturally there. Whatever it is that one desires, we don't need a separate shopping cart or supermarket of things that we might want. We just do this one thing. This is called faith. Shraddha shabde vishvas kahe sudrita nishtaya. By one thing, all other desirable things become accomplished. That's faith. Just like somebody might have faith, a businessman, that mentality is get money. And when you get money, everything else that you want, you can have. So, money, money, money. I have faith in somehow getting money. Or somebody else may have faith in get elected to some government post. So everything is centered on that one thing. Or the Olympic athlete, get the gold medal. It's so disciplined and so everything focused on one thing, because that's, to them, that's that one thing that represents happiness. Everything else becomes focused around that one thing. Similarly, the message of Bhagavad Gita is, by attaining this awakened state of consciousness, dormant state of consciousness of the soul that's described here, the reposing of our mind, and our full consciousness upon the Supreme, everything that we may want in life will be fulfilled by that one thing. That's a spiritual faith. And the teaching or the science of how to accomplish that is what's found in Bhagavad Gita. Are there regular classes or like discussions in Bhagavad Gita held here?
Every day we have Bhakti Vishwamara.
Okay, and you're discussing Bhagavad Gita in sequence?
Yes.
Okay. How many here are part of that Bhakti Vishwamara? Oh, very good. Okay. Sorry I couldn't come on a Friday, but there's only so many Fridays in the course of okay. I think I'll stop there, just see if there's some comments or discussion or questions. Something you'd like to contribute. Yeah?
So the true consciousness, I'm in a Buddha stage. So only thing I need to chant or
well there's two tracks. One is how the practical activities of your life can best enhance that awakening of spiritual consciousness. And then the activity that directly awakens spiritual consciousness. Both are needed. So hearing Bhagavad Gita and practically living your life accordingly. We can say, you know, framing one's life in the quality of goodness as far as possible. And then within that frame of the quality of goodness, the germination of the seed. So if the seed will grow nicely, that's the quality of goodness. Yeah. And habits of goodness like cleanliness, truthfulness, mercy, all the things that are universally understood as goodness, how to best accomplish that. What the real standards of cleanliness, truthfulness, mercy, so forth. What would they look like? Because they're described in the Bhagavad Gita. And in contrast, what other qualities of passion and ignorance are like? And to try to move one's life, your eating habits, your recreation habits, your cultivation of knowledge habits, according to the modes of nature, and frame one's life as far as one can in the quality of goodness. It helps germinate the seed. And then that which directly germinates the seed. And hearing Krishna's instructions, because they're coming from Krishna directly, that also the direct awakening of the dormant consciousness of the soul, or spiritual consciousness of the soul. In any, just like here in Corvallis, it's a university town, so as with any education, there's a teacher. So if we're going to learn the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita, there's a teacher of that knowledge. So there's it's a subset of hearing Bhagavad Gita is how to have the proper regard for the teacher of the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita. That's also being explained within fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. How to have proper relationships with others. Because relationships can be, you know, source of a lot of pain if they're not in proper order. And our minds will be distracted by that painful circumstance if we don't understand how to properly conduct relationships. So that's how we conduct our activities and the quality of goodness. Anything else? Yes?
Maharaj, basically I'm on the platform of materialistic platform this day. So what should be the goal of my life?
Well, what do you want the goal of your life to be? I mean, the premise is I'm on the materialistic platform. And then the question, what should my goal of my life be? Well, if you're on the materialistic platform, it's get money. That's the goal of life. Because then you can get what you want for the materialistic purposes.
Which is more important?
Which is more important?
What should be the goal of?
Well, what should be the goal is another question. We were reading and discussing this past weekend that according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, what you need for a healthy and happy life, that much endeavoring on the material side, one can do, one should do. Because if their needs, they're just their genuine needs of self-preservation and they're not met, you can't remain peaceful. But when one lives a spiritual life, self-preservation, you know, in other words, that which sustains my life, that much needs to be there. But that's not getting that which I need to sustain myself is not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is connecting with the Supreme. And then that becomes a subset. Just like a small child. The small child is being taken care of by the mother and father. The small child doesn't have to say, it's cold out, can I have a jacket? Mother or father, they're there with jackets when it's cold out, or I'm hungry, can I have something to eat? They're thinking, you know, make sure that our child has something to eat. The maintenance of the dependent is in the mind of those who are giving caregivers. So similarly, all living entities, Krishna declares this in Bhagavad Gita, he is the seed-giving father. So his mindfulness is similarly to maintain all his children, all his part and parcel living entities. So maintenance is not the main issue of life, although some people think that's the main issue of life, taking care of my necessities. But a higher state of consciousness is that God will take care. I'll let me work with my capacity to serve Him, and my necessities will be a subset of what comes from that service to Him. So the main consideration is where your consciousness goes. That should be the goal of life. Let my consciousness evolve to the point where it's fixed upon the Supreme. And in the course of life, let me live a good life, a virtuous life, with my consciousness fixed upon the Supreme. And whatever is supplied to take care of my necessities, I accept. God's mercy, Krishna's mercy. But what I just described is not the consciousness of a materialistic person. That was the premise of your question. I'm a materialistic person. I don't think you're a materialistic person, by the way. You're like every one of us. You have a material body. Spirit souls have material bodies, at least conditioned in this world. So there are demands of the body. Attend to them in a mood of devotion to the Supreme. Anything else?
specific way of reading Bhagavad Gita to start with each chapter? I mean, you start at chapter 1, continue like that, or to start?
The best thing about advice about how to read Bhagavad Gita is read in the association of persons who are experienced in the Bhagavad Gita. That's foremost. I mean, if you have a Bhagavad Gita in your home and you just pick up Bhagavad Gita and randomly open to any page and read, that's fine. But it's a conversation, so systematically, it's just like if you're having a conversation with a friend and I'm like, you know, come into the scene and you're in the middle of the conversation. I don't know what was said before. The context is not going to be clear because it's a conversation. There's like, you know, what was said before, what's going to be said later, and there's the whole context of the conversation. The Bhagavad Gita is similarly a conversation, and it helps to understand the preliminary things, but it also is good to know where it's all headed. And so if I'm going to understand properly something over here, it would be helpful to know what's over here. So that's why when you study with someone that's experienced, something that wiggles over here, it may resonate with something over here, and they'll have the bigger picture. It's helpful. But because the purports are presented with that bigger picture in mind, if you read the purport along with the verse, it becomes more clear. Anything? You're letting me off easy. How about you three that carry on this for the first time? Any thoughts?
Can I ask the significance of this?
Sure. The last time I was asked this question, I was traveling, checking in at an airport. Very nice lady in Nashville, Tennessee. She said, "What? Do you mind if I ask what that mark on your voice is like, you know, stapling thing?" I said, "Yeah, it's a mark that means the body is a temple of God." And she, like, listened, heard what it said. She was thoughtful, so I said a little more. Just like outside of a church, there's a cross. So, you know, amongst buildings, this is a place of worship. House of God, or a mosque, it's got another mark, or a temple, it has another mark, it's a chakra at the top. So this is a mark that says this body is a temple of God. Within this body is God, like the Bible teaches, the kingdom of God is within you. So this is the mark that says the kingdom of God is within you. And when the kingdom of God is within you, then what do you do with the body? Just like when you go inside the church, you're very reverential. There's certain things you just wouldn't do in a church because it's a church. And then when you go outside, you know, there's other things that you might do that you wouldn't do in a church. So similarly, this body is such that what goes into the body and what comes out of the body should be mindful of. This is God's in here. And we respect the body and respect others' bodies in the same way as the temple of God. Treat it accordingly. We know that. We just, like, forget it. So this helps us remember. And may help others also remember. And it's something to understand what it is. Like you see the cross on the top of the building of the church. It's a place of worship. You? Anything? Okay. You're all fine with everything you've heard.
Okay. Fine. Anyone?
I have a personal question for the user.
Okay. Then, Arpana, let's have some kirtan.